Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. Diane will be joining us for the next edition of our newest recurring segment, The Economist Mom. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. President Trump recently left the door open for at least a partial government shutdown if an upcoming budget deal does not include funding for a border wall. In quote, "We're talking about quite a big sum of money, about $5 billion," said the president. "This would be a very good time to do a shutdown. I don't think it's going to be necessary because I think the Democrats will come to their senses. And if they don't come to their senses, we will continue to win elections," he added. Congress has until December 7th to fund the rest of the government, with 7 of 12 appropriations bills still needing to be finalized for fiscal year 2019, which we're currently in. And just as a reminder, no shutdown is a good shutdown. There are signs that a compromised farm bill may finally take shape in the coming days. Both House and Senate negotiators say that they think they are close to wrapping up a draft conference report that would resolve the main sticking point, whether to toughen work requirements for able-bodied adults who receive food stamps. With no details of the agreement released so far, only time will tell what a resolution will look like. A financial fix for troubled pension plans could be coming next week. A bipartisan effort in the Joint Select Committee on Solvency of Multi-Employer Pension Plans, that's a mouthful, is working to get an agreement before the November 30th deadline imposed on the group. However, there is still no obvious consensus on how to shore up financially strapped pension plans that millions of union workers rely on. Potential fixes include long-term, low-interest loans to insolvent plans, large premium increases, diverting young workers from failed plans into new ones, increasing the retirement age for plans, or even benefit cuts. The Pentagon has apparently failed what is being called its first-ever comprehensive audit, according to high-level officials, and the discrepancies found are expected to take years to resolve. Deputy Secretary of Defense Patrick Shanahan said that while they failed the audit, they never expected to pass it. He added that the findings showed the need for greater discipline in financial matters within the Pentagon. Several DoD agencies received disclaimers, which means there were issues such as inventory discrepancies, information technology systems security issues, and financial reporting errors. Most discrepancies involved IT security, such as failing to revoke certificates of personnel no longer with the agency or using systems that could be hacked. Auditors did not find any evidence of fraud, nor did they report any problems related to civilian or military pay. And all of the services were able to account for all major military equipment. Up next, economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby for the next edition of the Economist Mom segment. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby. Bob and Diane are regular contributors on the show, and Diane is stepping away from her duties as a principal at the District Economics Group to share her expertise during this next Economist Mom segment. Welcome back to the show, Diane and Bob.
Thanks, Chase. Thanks, Chase.
We've spent the last several segments talking about presidential administrations, fiscal and economic policies and realities of those times, such as President Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton. Today, I wanted to talk about the current Trump administration, what fiscal policies are being presented, what the economic realities are, as well as what's being forecasted by agencies and organizations like the Congressional Budget Office or even the Concord Coalition. And I probably should warn our listeners, this is probably going to be another long segment, so buckle up. But before we jump into the Trump administration and what's going on right now, can you give a quick recap of the end of the Obama administration, what the economy was like, what kind of policies were being discussed leading up to the Trump presidency?
Well, I think the big piece of legislation fiscally during the Obama administration was the huge stimulus package and just the economic effect of the Great Recession on federal receipts as well as spending. So things started to quiet down as the economy strengthened and recovered from the Great Recession, which I believe the recovery started pretty early in the administration officially. You know, I think that President Obama had proposed some things repeatedly in his budget, his annual budget, that were had the flavor of different types of tax reform. For example, in terms of tax policy, I remember that he repeatedly had proposed capping itemized deductions at the 28% rate so that it wouldn't be worth more. Itemized deductions wouldn't be worth more to higher income households than lower income households. But that never passed. And then, you know, after we had been in recovery a while, President Obama, the Treasury Department, they started talking about the idea of business side tax reform. So they weren't talking that much about individual tax reform, except in the budget occasionally. But when it came to speaking out loud a little bit more about trying to find bipartisan solutions to make the tax system more efficient in how it creates revenue, they were open to business side tax reform. Now, the Obama administration, of course, wasn't really into the idea of cutting taxes on big corporations by a lot, but rather they were interested in tax reform that would help promote small business and lower effective tax rates on smaller businesses. The Republicans have always, congressional Republicans, tended to like that idea, but they also wanted to cut taxes on big corporations as well as small companies.
Didn't the Obama administration propose taking the rate, corporate tax rate, down to 28%?
That sounds familiar
to me. From 35,
it
was 35. I think as part of the reforms, they did have a
They were going to pay for that with some base broadeners. They were trying to kind of level. They had this idea of leveling the playing field across different forms of businesses. But they also had a little bit of flavor in there about punishing bad businesses like they wanted to raise effective tax rates on multinational companies, right? And, you know, try to encourage jobs at home rather than offshore jobs. So there was some bias against multinationals, as I recall, in the Obama proposals and the Obama approach, whereas congressional Republicans were more for, they weren't against broadening the base. But I think Republicans in Congress always wanted lower effective tax rates. So as Dave Camp found out, he was the chair of the Ways and Means Committee. He actually made a genuine effort to get out a more classic tax reform that economists could love that lowered marginal tax rates but broadened the tax base. So it turned out it was close to revenue neutral, if not actually revenue neutral. And then the fact that some Democrats were actually, and Democratic experts were actually praising it, got him in trouble with his own Republicans, because his own Republicans realized, well, if this is something Democrats can like, then we certainly can't like it. And then they figured out that because it was close to revenue neutral, it actually raised the effective tax rate on capital income, and that really went against a lot of what Republicans like. Republicans tend to favor lower effective tax rates on capital income. They're not very vocal about caring what happens to the effective tax rate on labor income, but they certainly don't want to raise effective tax rates on capital income because their argument is usually that those rates are already too high and that hurts economic growth. So that's been their kind of mantra on tax reform is, if anything, you cannot raise the average tax rate on capital, no matter what you do to marginal tax rate. So
I think it's the insistence on that point that has the effect on individual rates seem less important, but they're always in favor of lower rates.
They're always in favor of lower rates in general, and that sort of takes us to the Trump administration, actually.
Before we leave that, it was just a classic, that David Camp proposal, and he really got into the wonkiness of tax reform.
Yeah.
And this happens from time to time. He actually produced a very well-respected
bill among tax experts.
Thought, wow, this is really good.
This is pretty
good. And so, as you might expect, well, a lot of tax experts thought, this is really carefully thought out. It was just totally rejected on the Hill politically.
Yeah.
Nobody see it. Just was an orphan politically. Nobody, and Dave Camp retired, and that was the last anybody heard of it.
Right.
Before we get into the Trump administration and policies that have come out since then, am I right in thinking that at least recently, when tax reform was a topic, or has been a topic, and proposals have been put forth, that they're largely politically driven? I know we mentioned that Camp's was relatively revenue neutral, which got him in trouble with his own party. But it sounds like there's a really deep political divide on how Democrats and Republicans wanted to approach this. And that's what got us into maybe the proposals of the Trump administration. Am I right in thinking that it is, in most cases, a politically driven issue as opposed to an economically driven issue?
Well, I would say that the politics of tax reform are very much defined by what are you doing to revenue as a share of GDP? And disagreements about that, more than the shape of tax reform, like everyone kind of understands, even the politicians, that it's better to have lower marginal rates because that reduces the distortions the tax system places on economic decisions. But there's disagreement about what should you do with the base. Should you raise, enlarge the tax base so you're taxing more income at lower rates? Should you enlarge the base enough so that your average tax rate and the revenue that you're raising is constant, or should you fall short of that, or should you even exceed that? So, I would say that Democrats and Republicans on tax policy tend to split and disagree. No matter how much they agree on the shape of good tax policy, they disagree about the size of the tax system. And that has been a major sticking point. You can explain it. I mean, politically, many Republicans, almost all, if not all of them, had signed a no new taxes pledge during the George W. Bush administration, wasn't it, Bob? I'm trying to remember when that dates back to. Grover Norquist.
Yeah, that's when it started.
Grover Norquist.
I don't know when it
pledge.
Started, but it reached its peak.
Yeah.
And
then there there are debates about what does that mean, no new taxes? Does that mean no increase in revenue? Does it mean no increase in marginal tax rates? Does it mean no new tax bases, right? There's disagreement about what that technically means, but Republicans have often taken the most strict interpretation of that so that they don't want to raise a penny more of revenue, not just that they don't want to raise tax rates. And that's been a problem.
Related to that is the whole question of the effect of a tax cut, because you'll get the argument that if you cut the taxes, you'll get more revenue, or at least you won't lose revenue because it'll stimulate economic activity, which will then be taxed, and you'll end up with as much revenue. And so some of the Republican proposals include that so-called dynamic scoring to achieve revenue neutrality. And again, there are philosophical differences about how you, the extent to which you have some sort of economic feedback.
What was the fiscal and economic reality the Trump administration was facing in 2017 when it took office, and what policies have we seen since then?
Well, I can sort of tee things up here. We'd had the Great Recession, and the deficit and the debt exploded as a result of that, and policies enacted to combat that, which tend to include tax cuts and spending increases during the Obama years. But towards the end of the Obama years, the budget deficit began to decline. Of course, the debt would continue to go up, but the annual budget deficits were declining, from a peak of almost 9% or over 9% of GDP very early in administration, all the way down to less than 3% of GDP in 2015 and 14. So, it appeared that if we had come back to quote-unquote normal through fighting through the problem years. I kind of look at the Obama administration as fighting an emergency economic disruption through the first part of its tenure, and then having gotten back to kind of where he thought he would be fiscally towards the end of his administration, with the deficit around 3% of GDP and these long-term issues of the baby boomers' retirement and the impact that would have on the budget really beginning to impact, because 8 years had gone by, and one of the most significant things that happened during that time was the baby boomers passed the magic age of eligibility for Social Security and Medicare during the Obama administration. So that's about where we were as Trump took office, the budget deficit around 3% of GDP and growing, I should add.
Bob, what was what were, do you have revenues and spending?
Revenue was right around average, 17.7% of GDP at the end of the Obama administration. Of course, it had fallen way like 14%, you know, during the recession. So it was, again, getting back up to normal. Normal is about 17.5% of GDP. And that's
in terms of a
50-year average. And there are problems with looking at that going forward. Mm-hmm. But let's just say steady state is about 17%, 17.5%, about 21% of GDP on spending, which, again, is about normal.
We're used to that level. Yeah.
There's somewhere. So that, again, and the deficit around 3%. So if you look at in historical perspectives, at the end of the Obama administration, you were just about at the average,
which doesn't mean
doesn't mean all problems have gone away.
It doesn't mean it's going to stay there.
Because the debt had gone up from, you know, about 38% of GDP or something to like 78% of GDP. So there was a big run up in debt. And but that's kind of where we were. So I kind of look at it as a major turning point where Congress and the new president would say, okay, with the disruption of the Great Recession is over, the boomers have begun to retire, we need a new comprehensive plan.
Yeah.
What do we do?
And I remember during the 2016 cycle, now President Trump participating in a little series called Fiscal Fridays, where I believe on that show he was explaining how terrible the debt was and how it needed to be rectified. And he threw out ideas on how he would do it, whether realistic or not. And then since then, he has said, I'll put out a plan to get rid of the debt within 8 years. And I think that, from my perspective, tease up nicely for you, Diane, what kind of policies we've actually seen under the Trump administration and the Republican Congress?
Well, we have seen, I mean, the biggest piece of legislation during the Trump administration so far has been the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was passed at the end of 2017 and took effect in January 2018 for the 2018 tax year that we're in now. It was a great big tax cut, especially for the business sector and also for higher income households, if you look at it from a distributional perspective. And I think that unlike the Camp proposal, I think a lot of economists who study tax policy thought it was an odd thing to propose at this time in our country because of the current condition of the economy not really aligning with any, you know, good economic justification for a massive tax cut, which I believe it was about the size of the Bush tax cuts that were so contentious in 2001. So, yeah, I think that there has been a little bit of, you know, shock and awe among the fiscal policy community about the reacting to the fact that this big tax cut passed because it added, you know, trillions of dollars to the deficits and debt. It was not well motivated in terms of economic reasoning, and it was not well distributed from a household distribution standpoint.
One of the things that I think was significant in this was a major proposal. He had run on this as a not at the specifics of it, just the idea of having a big tax cut. Initially, on the Hill, Speaker Paul Ryan and Kevin Brady, who was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and so he was in the old David Camp position. And we should say David Camp was a Republican.
Member of the committee. We did not make that clear, but yes.
I say that so that later criticisms are not meant to be partisan, that we're giving praise to the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. So Ryan and Brady, as I recall, suggested early on that the tax bill, whatever they came up with, should be revenue neutral. Now, that would include in their scoring a dynamic effect on the economy. Then on the Senate side, Mitch McConnell decided that they didn't have to pay for it, that it didn't have to be revenue neutral. And I didn't quite get that. But anyway, because of course, that was fine with Trump. He didn't want to have to come up with policies to offset the lost revenue. And he had pledged not to touch major social insurance programs like Social Security and Medicare during the campaign. And so Ryan and Brady weren't able to, stand against the Senate and the president. If they were saying, in effect, deficits don't matter, and we've got this magic formula that economic growth is going to take care of the whole thing, then the House was willing to go along with it. So there was a moment when they could have done the David Camp approach and tried to pay for a major tax reform through other policies that would leave you with lower rates and a more efficient tax code and more revenue coming in. But they made, this is the significant point to me, they made an explicit promise to not worry about it.
Yeah.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. In our recurring segment, The Economist Mom, we're currently discussing the Trump administration and fiscal policies that have been coming out of it in the first couple of years as we head into 2019 after the midterm elections. And I think, Bob, something you just mentioned really stood out to me, and I think that it underscored sort of my biggest disappointment with really the latest tax code reform or overhaul, depending on whatever you want to call it, was that there was suddenly this shift to not paying for it, and everyone sort of fell in line with that. And I think that was what was most disheartening to me. And along those lines, how much is it projected? How much is that tax cut projected to even cost over the next couple of years? Because I know we've been talking a lot about growing budget deficits and, a $21.6 trillion debt. But has there been a specific amount attributed to what the cost of this tax reform might be?
Yeah, I mean, the CBO has looked at this pretty extensively. That's the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan agency that's in charge of scoring these things. So they looked at a couple of different effects. One is the effect on the primary deficit, so to speak, which is not including interest costs. And they said it would cost about $1.8 trillion over 10 years. But then they also said, well, okay, the dynamic score, meaning, the positive impact from fiscal effects would add back about almost $600 billion to that. So they're giving the tax bill some credit for stimulating economic growth, but not paying for itself. So that led CBO to come up with a net figure of about $1.3 trillion effect on the deficit. So that's a pretty big hit. But because you're running big deficits, you're also running higher interest costs because you have to include that in the cost of the tax cut as well, because it adds to federal outlays on interest cost, which was another close to $600 billion. So in other words, the effect on the interest cost just about cancels out evenly, a one-for-one swap, dynamic effect on the economy. So basically, CBO's end result was over 10 years, when all is said and done, dynamic effects on the increased interest cost, it's about $1.9 trillion.
Wow, with interest.
Yeah, with the interest, and including the positive feedback from economic stimulus.
Just to, I believe that that official cost or revenue estimate had to, one feature of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was that the individual income tax, the tax cuts that go to households, are they actually expire. What year is it that they expire? Like
2025.
2025. And so that is a revenue estimate, assuming they expire.
Right.
And, so, and there were promises at leading up to the midterm about extending those beyond 2025.
Oh, I'm sure there were. Right.
So what,
I mean, I guess we have seen this before in the, you know, when the Bush tax cuts were enacted in 2001, one of the things that we didn't like about it, them from a budgetary standpoint, is that they, the revenue estimate wasn't really an estimate of its full permanent cost because the Bush tax cuts were set to expire at the end of 2010, which was before the end of the budget window. It was a little bit better than this proposal. They're expiring kind of right in the middle of the budget window instead of at the end. And so we've seen this before that, you know, when organizations like Concord put out their a more realistic baseline of the cost of a piece of legislation. We typically would assume that if a tax cut is scheduled to expire in current law, and therefore a CBO has to count the cost as if it will expire, realistically, we know that the trouble with temporary tax cuts is they're never really temporary. They just keep getting extended over and over again. And so it masks, it kind of disguises the true cost of these proposals. So, you know, we at Concord Coalition, we consider a policy extended baseline. CBO has their own policy extended baseline that they have to consider, especially when they do longer term projections.
It would be another $650 billion,
so,
according
so
to CBO, too, not including interest
right.
costs.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The expiring tax cuts.
So it might be a good time to sort of tally up the numbers, Bob. I think we've talked about different figures. You know, $1.8 or $9 trillion here, and $650 billion there. On top of, I think discretionary spending had been raised in the last couple of years. In addition, with about a $10 trillion increase in deficits over the next decade, we're not looking at insignificant numbers. We're looking at a pretty rapid buildup. Am I right?
Yes. The situation was already bad enough. And so if you extend the tax cuts, you know, you're 2.4 trillion or something like that.
Without interest.
Yeah, without interest. And maybe there'd be some positive economic impact that would be canceled out by the interest. So who knows? Maybe it's 200. I don't know. But that was the effect of it. The spending that's been added has been less problematic in the sense that it was raising caps for 2 years. And while that was something like raising the caps by 300 and something billion over 2 years, that has a short-term effect, which is contributing to the current sugar high in the economy. So what they did was they did cut, they raised the caps for the 2018 and 2019, but they left alone the caps for 2020 and 2021. So we, in effect, have a fiscal cliff.
A mini cliff.
Yeah, a little mini cliff coming up this year when they start looking at appropriations bills. Under the caps, they're going to have to cut quite a bit. I think it's like around a 10% cut or something. And so they're probably going to end up raising them. But the right. point is that the tax changes, for the most part, are permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And the spending changes, for the most part, are only for the next couple of years. So, you know, when you start weighing them as to what's had a more important impact on the deficit, you'd say, well, they cut revenues more than they raised spending. But they did both. And the net effect is obviously an even worse outlook.
And Diane, a question I have for you, something you mentioned earlier in the show was the timing for this latest tax cut seemed odd to you and other economists. So my question is,
right,
what are you and other economists saying about the current economy and the future economy and how this tax cut might interact and impact the growth or maybe a lack of growth moving forward?
Well, you know, I think the claim that any politician would like to make at the time that they're proposing a tax cut of any shape or size is that it will help create jobs. That's the one thing you want to be able to claim, is that it'll create jobs. And so that was a claim put on this bill. In fact, we've seen lots of job growth. So it's hard to dispute it just on like looking at what the economy's doing and saying, oh, we cut taxes and there are more jobs, so there must be a causal relationship there. Most economists were not happy with the type of tax cut this was because it was primarily a large kind of cash flow stimulative tax cut. And there are two ways that tax cuts affect economic activity. They can affect the demand side of the economy and they can affect the supply side of the economy. And when the economy is in a recession, you really want to stimulate demand because the problem is there's excess capacity. There are workers who are unemployed. There are shuttered factories. There are empty buildings. And that just means that our capacity to in the economy is bigger than the activity. And so the only way to increase GDP, economic activity, is to increase demand because we already have too much supply relative to demand. That's when you talk about, oh, you actually want a deficit finance tax cut because you want to increase the cash flow from the government into the private sector in order to stimulate demand. The problem was that this is largely what most economists think the effect of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was. It was certainly a transfer of money from the government's budget to the private sector. But it was coming at a time when the problem in the economy, there wasn't much of a problem in the economy in terms of unemployment and excess capacity. The problem or the we're kind of back to longer term problems, which are on the supply side, which is once you have once all the workers are back to work, once all the offices are filled again, the question becomes, how do you increase economic activity? Well, if all the current capacity is in use, then you want to increase capacity. And that means you want people to actually join the labor force who weren't in the labor force, or work more who were working only part-time, or you want greater investment. You want more dollars to toward capital investment so that there's more capital to work with in the economy. So you want to basically increase the supply side of the economy. And that's when so-called supply side tax cuts look appealing, where you're cutting marginal tax rates and increasing economic incentives to work and to save. And so that was the claim, or that was the hope, that this tax cut would be kind of a supply side mostly tax cut. But the problem is that a true supply side tax cut should not be deficit financed. You can get to get the most the surest kind of effect, positive effect on labor supply and saving in the economy. You can't deficit finance it because deficit financing is negative public saving. And that is dollar for dollar, for every deficit finance tax cut, you are reducing national saving, not just public saving. And then you have to count on the marginal tax rate cut to stimulate private saving enough to offset the decrease in public saving in order to have a net positive effect on national saving. And so from a supply side perspective, the fact that this was such a hugely deficit financed tax cut meant that it looked a lot more like a stimulus tax cut, the kind of tax cut you'd want when unemployment is high and demand is low and there's excess capacity in the economy. And that was not the economy we were in. And if it's not the economy we were in, we should have had a different kind of tax cut, in particular with respect to the deficit financing. That was the mistake.
Wrong medicine.
Yes. Wrong medicine, wrong time. So, Bob and Diane, we have a couple minutes left in the segment here, and I want to switch gears a little bit. We've talked a lot about tax reform and its impacts under the Trump administration, the growth of some areas of discretionary spending. We haven't talked a lot about some of the bigger areas of spending like Medicare and Social Security. And we've got a divided government we're walking into in 2019. So my question for you is, what are some areas, whether it be tax reform again or other issues, what are some areas we could anticipate some attempts at reform, maybe going into 2020 with another presidential cycle? And maybe if there's nothing realistic that will actually be done, what would you hope to see some attempts made at?
Well, I'll take a couple of hopeful swings at that, probably about as hopeful as though I was standing at the plate at Fenway Park.
just throw a bunt down, Bob.
I'd be lucky to get one in play. I think that the possibilities are that there could be something done on health care reform. That may sound silly, but I mean, if they do something about working together on prescription drug costs, possibly some sort of infrastructure bill. The problem I have is whether they would do any of that in a quote-unquote fiscally responsible way. You know, here's where gridlock may help. I mean, I don't know that they're really either side is willing to have the other side involved in a joint victory. I mean, this is a real serious political problem we have where some folks just seem like, well, we don't want to share credit for anything. If we can do something on our own, that's much better because then we have credit for it. And if it doesn't work out, we can blame the other side. People don't seem to want to come out together and say, well, you know, we wanted to work something out together, so we did. Those people are now referred to as chumps or losers or something. So I don't know. I'm not hopeful that there are areas where the two parties have some common interest. The question is whether they can get over their political problems.
Yeah, and I think on the tax front, it's just we're going to need more revenue eventually, but it doesn't seem like that's going to happen until we get to a much more obvious crisis in the economy about credit markets overall. Like this time around, it may be the government sector that puts the whole economy, into a credit crisis. Last time around, it was, you know, subprime mortgages that started us down the path to the Great Recession. I think that, you know, Chase, you mentioned earlier on about tax reform and how, you know, this was not the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was not a revenue neutral tax reform that economists had hoped for. Well, we haven't seen revenue neutral tax reform, honestly, since 1986. So,
that's depressing.
I mean, we've had tax increases before, like in 93, that was a big deal because it raised revenue and we needed it then, but then it quickly got whittled away over the years. But the last fundamental reform where we broadened base, lowered rates in a way that raised the same amount of revenue was in 1986. And politically, there's just no appetite. You know, it kind of is amazing that they did that in 1986 because, you know, when you have revenue-neutral tax reform, there are winners and losers, and the losers become really obvious and vocal, and the winners tend to be more diffuse. When you know, the advantages of leveling the playing field, that by definition is like making it better for the whole economy, and so it's diffuse benefit for a very obvious specific cost, usually imposed on people that currently, businesses and industries that currently benefit a lot from the tech system, and so will be very vocal to oppose it. So politically, we're not likely to see the kind of tax reform that we probably need in this country, you know, until it's absolutely forced on politicians because we absolutely have to do something about the deficit from an economic perspective. And then there will be less appetite to cut spending than to raise revenues. The easiest thing to do would be to raise tax rates.
I'm going
to
end this segment on a high note so it's not a downer of an economist mom and say, I'm hoping for something amazing. sort of what you just said about how in the 80s it was sort of amazing they managed to get revenue neutral tax reform. I'm hoping that leadership on both sides of the aisle could wake up and see this as an opportunity, and maybe a miracle happens, Bob, on some of these major issues that absolutely need to be addressed. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during the Economist Mom segment. Thank you both for joining the show once again.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Complaints from both parties, a bipartisan joint committee, and a budget process that hobbles along each year apparently won't be enough to bring about significant reform within that budget process. Amid bipartisan frustration over the federal budget process, Congress last spring created a special committee to develop reforms that could enable lawmakers to pass spending bills on schedule and in a more effective and thoughtful manner. There were high hopes that the 8 Democrats and 8 Republicans on the committee would present sweeping recommendations. As the committee chairs unveiled draft legislation last week, however, it became clear that the panel had failed to reach agreement on many potential reforms. One notable proposal that has received support would be to switch the budget process from an annual to a biennial cycle, which could have some positive benefits. But despite months of hearings and discussions among themselves, committee members were unable to reach agreement on the broader recommendations for which many lawmakers, deficit hawks, and others had hoped for. A point that has been made by some committee members themselves. Representative John Yarmuth of Kentucky, the ranking Democrat on the House Budget Committee, called the Joint Committee's proposals incremental and suggested they would, quote, help a little bit, faint praise indeed. Senator James Langford, a Republican from Oklahoma, was even less enthusiastic, issuing a press release saying that the $21 trillion federal debt called for significant reform, not just tweaks around the edges. The Joint Committee met last week to review proposed legislation that had been prepared by the panel's co-chairs. The committee accepted 3 proposed amendments and rejected a number of others. But there was no final vote, and even the Joint Committee's modest bipartisan proposals face uncertainty in the weeks ahead. The committee suspended its markup session on the legislation until November 27th, only 3 days ahead of its deadline to report a bill to Congress. The panel is apparently still struggling with internal disagreements and seem to get bogged down in confusion over possible impacts on the complex budget procedure known as reconciliation. As the Concord Coalition said when the special committee began meeting in March, there is certainly room for improvement in the current budget process. Year after year, that process has broken down, with Congress failing to make final spending decisions for each fiscal year until way after the year has started. This year is no exception. Facing possible government shutdowns, Congress passes one or more stopgap measures that generally continue federal spending at previous levels, regardless of changing circumstances and shifting priorities, as lawmakers continue to struggle with final funding decisions. Falling back on these continuing resolutions fosters government inefficiency and costs taxpayers money. This messy process is currently on display once again, with the latest continuing resolution set to expire December 7th, disagreement over the remaining spending bills, and the threat of a shutdown by the president. The Concord Coalition has long supported the idea of biennial budgeting. Replacing the annual budget cycle with a 2-year process is no silver bullet, but it would likely be more efficient and would give lawmakers more time to focus on oversight and possible solutions to the country's difficult mid-range and long-term fiscal challenges. But many other changes are also needed. For example, pay-as-you-go rules should be strengthened so that advocates of spending and tax reduction proposals are required to find responsible ways to pay for them rather than simply boosting the deficit over and over again. The reconciliation process, which has been used to avoid Senate filibusters, needs repairs so that it cannot be misused to boost federal deficits. Another problem with the current budget process is the federal debt limit itself. In its current form, this limit has obviously failed to impose fiscal discipline. Instead, it has become a tool for partisan bickering and fiscal brinksmanship that could destabilize global financial markets. If we were even to have a debt limit, it should be linked in a meaningful way to the fiscal policy decisions that create the need for additional federal borrowing in the first place. No one should be allowed to use the debt limit to threaten defaults by the U.S. government on financial obligations it has already incurred. One of the Joint Committee's co-chairs recently said that while nobody on the committee got everything they wanted, Republicans and Democrats, quote, found consensus to move the ball forward in certain areas. We'll soon see whether the ball has indeed been moved forward, but in any case, as the federal debt continues to rise rapidly, the next Congress will need to do more. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.